The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On this week's podcast, we go to the edge of physics.
What these scientists are doing is they are using waters that are about a kilometer and a half beneath the surface of Lake Baikal as the detector material, and you're waiting for these flashes of blue light.
What does the UK election mean for science?
If you look at the Science and Technology Select Committee as well, that was doing so much good work last year, there's only one surviving member of that left.
Do animals have a right to privacy?
I wouldn't mind if there was a frog watching me, say, having a poo. But if I was once having a poo and a cat was watching me and I felt quite odd about it.
And it turns out that humans just couldn't get enough of those Neanderthals. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Welcome, everyone. In the studio today are The Guardian's Nell Bowes and science correspondent Ian Sample. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Did you enjoy the election coverage? Can you give us a hint about... We're going to talk about this later, but give us a hint. Are you positive or negative about the whole thing? How are you feeling?
Bewildered, actually. Bewildered and depressed on the science front.
Although they did have Brian Cox on Channel 4, which is, you know,
talking about
bonus.
Physics?
Yes, actually talking about catastrophes for the Earth.
given that this is going out on Monday and we have no idea who's going to be the Prime Minister today, so welcome to the Conservative / Lib Dem / Labour overlord. Also here in the studio is Anil Anandswamy. He's a consulting editor at New Scientist and author of a new book called The Edge of Physics. This book covers some of the deepest mysteries of our universe. How do you detect dark matter? What might a neutrino be like? And why do you need to go to the edges of the Earth to find out? As its title suggests, this is a book about physics and about the scientists who do their work at the world's most extreme places, from Chile's Atacama Desert to Siberia's Lake Baikal. Anil, welcome.
Thank you.
Is there a central theme to what you were trying to get across by going to these sorts of very remote places?
Yes, I think if there's a theme in terms of the science and the physics, it's that the questions in physics have gotten so difficult to answer now that it's not enough anymore to do experiments in our labs in universities. It's not enough to point telescopes at the skies from your local mountaintop. You really need to get to very extreme places, places which are environmentally very quiet. And what I mean by that is places that are devoid of light pollution, of electromagnetic noise. And these regions are literally at the ends of the Earth. We need to explore the cosmos in ways that we wouldn't have dreamed of 100 years ago.
And so these scientists are essentially explorers into very uninhabited places. Can you take us through like a couple of the experiments that you saw? What kinds of things were they looking for?
One of my favorite journeys was to Lake Baikal in Siberia, which you just mentioned. Lake Baikal is being used, the waters of the lake itself are being used as a detector material for detecting neutrinos. Now, neutrinos are subatomic particles that are everywhere, and the ones that we are trying to detect come from outer space. The idea there is that when a neutrino hits a water molecule, it creates a flash of blue light.
And this is extremely rare, though. Neutrinos just don't interact with anything.
Exactly. So, which is precisely why you need to monitor really large bodies of water so that your chances of seeing such a collision of a neutrino with a water molecule is high enough. And what these scientists are doing is they are using waters that are about a kilometer and a half beneath the surface of Lake Baikal as the detector material. They have these things called photomultiplier tubes, which are like artificial eyes that you submerged into the lake, and you're waiting for these flashes of blue light. Now, what happens is that the Russians and a few German scientists who are working on this experiment, which is called the Lake Baikal Neutrino Telescope, they don't have enough money to work during spring and summer months, because if they were to work during spring and summer, they would need ships and submersibles to essentially do their work. They don't have enough money, so they wait until winter when the lake is completely frozen over, and then they use the frozen surface of the lake as a platform to establish their ice camp. They set up the ice camp, they cut holes in the ice, which can be up to a meter thick or more. And then they send in their divers to locate the telescope, which is actually just these submerged photomultiplier tubes deep inside the lake. And they get them out, do their repairs, maintenance, and then they have to get out before the ice melts and cracks. And they literally have just 2 months to do their work.
These places, as you suggest, are not easy to get to. They're not easy access laboratories that people might think of when it comes to high-tech science.
Not at all. And again, the Lake Baikal Neutrino Telescope is a case in point. You know, just to get from London to this place, it was a flight to Moscow, then another long flight to Irkutsk, and from there, a long, long drive to the site of the ice camp. Most of it was over the frozen lake, and I was actually
driving over the frozen lake. What, in a 4x4 or something?
It was a very old Russian military jeep. And
were you worried about it going through?
I was extremely worried about it because I had imagined from my sort of room in London that I would actually go to this experiment site. Spend a few days on the shore before ever venturing out onto the lake. And as it happened, you couldn't get to the ice camp without actually driving on the lake. And that was a very scary moment when I realized that we were actually on the lake.
Ian?
One of the things I loved about your chapter here is your description of the guys, and it does seem to be mostly sort of well-padded, gruff men living in these conditions, which are pretty damn extreme. It was a lovely picture you painted.
Certainly not people with leather arm patches and tweed jackets sitting in labs.
No, it's not. They really are working on an extremely small budget. To give you an idea, they have spent only about $20 million over 20 years of functioning of this telescope. And to contrast that with similar neutrino telescopes being built elsewhere, they are costing hundreds of millions in just a matter of a few years. So they're reusing, the Lake Baikal experiment is reusing old railway buildings that were actually built for the old Trans-Siberian Railway. So those buildings are being reused. It is ramshackle. I won't even go into what the toilet was like. But and I was warned about this even before I got to Lake Baikal, to Siberia. The German scientist whom I had met earlier had told me that, expect rough conditions. And they make, they do an amazing job. It really is an expedition. They call it an expedition, and that's what it is.
No?
I was interested in thinking about neutrino telescopes elsewhere or neutrino experiments in your Antarctic experiences, kind of having always rather wanted to go. Do you think the people who work in these far-flung places differ differ properly from people working in labs in the UK or in the States?
I think they do. I think the experimental physicists, the engineers who have to travel to these places, they are very hardy people, I think. And also they are a curious bunch in the sense that I think they wouldn't be happy sitting around in labs and in offices. They somehow need to get out there. And, physics in these extreme places provides them just the opportunity to do so.
Now, we'll talk about one more slightly extreme place before tying up, which is the Atacama Desert in Chile. This is the one place out of all the places you mentioned in your book that I've actually been as well. Again, very hard to describe, apart from saying it looks a bit like the surface of what you might imagine Mars might look like. A very, very dry, very red place. But this is the home of some quite stunning telescopes, for everything from the very large telescope that the European Southern Observatory runs to the Atacama Large Millimeter Array. What makes this particular place in the world so good for this sort of astronomy research?
Well, first of all, it's the desert is a high altitude desert, so most of it is in the Chilean Andes. And what that means is that your telescopes, when you're building it on mountaintops, you are above most of the Earth's lower layers of Earth's atmosphere. So, and those lower layers are really bad for telescopes because they create a lot of problems for light. Light that might have traveled for billions of years comes and gets smudged by the very last fractions of a second of, its entry into the Earth's atmosphere. So by building something on mountaintops, you're above these turbulent layers. But then Atacama Desert is also special because it's very dry. Some parts of this place have not seen rainfall for decades. And a dry atmosphere, again, is very good for telescopes. And on top of all that, there's a very interesting climatic condition. There's a cold current that flows along the Chilean coast. It's called the Humboldt Current. And the effect of that Humboldt Current is to suck down the clouds. Cloud cover to below the summit of these mountains. So most of these mountaintops actually get about 300 days of clear skies because the clouds are well below the summits.
I thought in bringing together all of these experiments, you really got a sense of the sort of how real and alive this the sort of human appetite for discovery and understanding stuff is. And I found it just really heartening that we're funding people to build neutrino detectors out of a cubic kilometer of ice and things like that. It was just, I thought it was fun and exciting.
Not very much, it seems. 20 million over 20 years is not a huge amount, is it?
No. Major so research? he's yeah. referring, Ian is referring to the Ice Cube Neutrino Telescope, which is costing 300 million over a few years. It's at the South Pole. They're literally instrumenting a cubic kilometer of East Antarctic ice, which is about 2.5 kilometers beneath the surface at the South Pole.
Okay, well, we'll leave that there for now. Anil's book, The Edge of Physics, is out now.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk with Alok Jha.
Now, while we remember, ever wanted to see how closely Ian Sample resembles Daniel Craig? Well, perhaps you've always wanted a signed talking photo of the smooth-tongued Nell Bowes. Or maybe you just want to talk to dashing producer Andy about his mic technique. Well, all your dreams can soon come true. Put this date in your diary, Wednesday the 26th of May, and the location, London. That's right, after 4 years of podcasting, we're ready to take Science Weekly on the road. Perhaps because they've been distracted by the election, but our bosses seem to raise no objection at all when we suggested that we should record an edition of this podcast live in front of a real audience. More details will follow, but put the evening of Wednesday the 26th of May in your diary right now. We'll put a link to the event on our Facebook wall, so go ahead and join that if you want the full up-to-date skinny. And in case you don't know, the Facebook group is called The Guardian's Science Weekly Podcast. You may have noticed that an election is taking place in the UK. There's plenty of uncertainty around the time of recording, but whilst the dust settles, what we do know for certain is that some of those standing up for science haven't been voted back in. Notably, and most regrettably, the Lib Dem science spokesperson, Dr. Evan Harris, lost his Oxford West and Abingdon seat to the Tories by just 176 votes. He tweeted, "Sorry that you guys have had to share my disappointment. Thanks for the messages. I'm okay, and we'll come back from this and re-win." Also, Conservative Joanne Cash, who is standing for libel reform, lost out to Labour. On a slight positive note, this also happened.
And I hereby declare that Caroline Lucas is duly elected Member of Parliament for the Brighton Pavilion constituency.
Thank you. Tonight, the people of Brighton Pavilion have made history by electing Britain's first Green MP to Westminster.
It is a great breakthrough, particularly given that we are fighting against such an undemocratic electoral system. You know, this is an archaic system that is expressly designed to keep out smaller parties, to keep out different voices.
Now, to go through some of this, let's speak to our politics expert, Martin Robbins, who was on the podcast last week. Martin, how are you feeling this morning on the sort of science front?
Well, I'm flattered to be an expert now.
You're 1 week and you're a media expert. This is what happens.
Well, I mean, it's been pretty poor, to be honest. I think Mark Henderson over at the Times has totted up the number of people sort of qualified in science now, and we've dropped from 86 MPs to 71. And if you look at the Science and Technology Select Committee as well, that was doing so much good work last year, there's only one surviving member of that left, once you take into account the seat losses and retirements. And of course, we've lost some very high-profile advocates, people like Evan Harris, who's been deposed by a fairly committed Christian in that area, and people like Joanne Cash. So it's not been a great outcome, to be honest.
What happens now? There are a couple of MPs that have been voted in, Julian Huppert at Cambridge, for example, who have science backgrounds. And as you said, the number of total MPs who've got science backgrounds has dropped. But are there any promising people in the new crop that might take up Evan's sort of mantle?
Well, I think we'll have to see. I think how the next Science and Technology Select Committee is formed is going to be an interesting one. But I think at the moment it's all overshadowed by the kind of national situation. I mean, we've managed to get to a point where nobody's won the election. And what sort of effect that has, I mean, we've no idea who the science minister would be or what sort of people would be in the thing that all the ministers go to, cabinet, that's the word.
Say that again.
It's been a long night.
It's been a long night, right?
I was up very late.
Martin, I was just interested in your thoughts on Caroline Lucas getting in the first Green MP.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm going to have to disagree with the podcast introduction there. I'm not particularly delighted to see Caroline Lucas get in. I think she's a bit of a wild card, would be the most generous way of putting it. Certainly sort of good on some environmental issues, but if she starts talking nonsense about other areas, then, you know, it could just as equally be bad for science if we're going to end up with, you know, more opposition to GM or sort of nonsense about animal testing and things like that. So
I thought you were going to be their science policy expert, though, and inject some science into the Green Party. Wasn't that your task last week?
Well, my needle was only so big, and there's a lot of party to inject science into. So
on a science front, definitely. I mean, from an environmental point, I think that the signal that the first Green Party MP has been elected is not such a bad thing if you want to push things like climate change up the agenda. I mean, I agree with you on the GM stuff, but then that's a debate that's not going to happen in Parliament anytime soon anyway. So it's not really much of an issue. But she does she has done well, I think, to give her some credit, as an MEP and other places too, in pushing the need for action on climate change.
On the flip side, they're going to be under a lot more scrutiny now. I think now that they've got an MP in place, they're going to have more funding, they're going to be more active in that area, and there's going to be a lot more attention paid to the things that they say. And I think if they're not careful, that could work against them as well as for them. And you wouldn't want to sort of, you know, cast wider lack of credibility on the green movement.
Martin, hi, it's Ian again. Just a final thought. What should we? What would our dream job for Evan Harris be now? Until we can find a way of bringing him back into politics.
Well, surely Lord Harris.
Lord Harris. This was going to be my suggestion.
I think the campaign starts here.
Lord Harris in the benches. Martin, thank you very much.
No problem.
Anil, how closely do you follow the UK science politics scene?
Not as closely as you guys, because I did get a good night's sleep. So, but just thinking about the implications for science, it's been interesting. The last couple of years, we've seen a change in the sentiment in the US with the Obama administration coming in. Science is a little more front and center than it used to be, has more legitimacy in US politics than it used to have. And while I don't know the effect that the current UK elections will have on science policy here, it's interesting that you guys are all concerned about it. Because for me, as a US citizen living in the UK, UK politics have always seemed to be sensible when it came to science and technology. And if that were to change, that would be quite a flip, given that the US seems to be going the other way now.
The US does have some very partisan views on this sort of stuff. All right, well, we're going to leave all of that stuff there. You can follow this podcast on Twitter, by the way. Our handle is @ScienceWeekly, and we'll let you know every time a new podcast is launched there. For all the Guardian Science content, follow @GuardianScience. And talking of Twitter, Ian Sample's finally on board. Literally, you can see a fetching picture of him surfing at his Twitter page, @IanSample.
Are we allowed to take the piss out of Ian's surfing photo?
Well, there's nothing to take the piss out of. It's very manly, I think. I
just chose it because it made me happy.
Aww.
Yeah, anyway. And if you want to follow me, I'm Alok Jha. And Anil, is there a Twitter feed for The Edge of Physics?
Yeah, it's just called Edge of Physics.
Excellent. For all your neutrino goodness, you can go to that.
I set up a Twitter account 3 years ago, but I don't tweet.
She just follows.
Science Weekly from Guardian.co.uk.
Let's have a look now at some of the other science stories this week.
News Jack.
Not getting enough sleep could apparently send you to an early grave. But researchers have also found that too much could be a problem as well. The study found that those who generally slept for less than 6 hours a night were 12% more likely to experience a premature death over a period of 25 years than those who consistently got 6 to 8 hours sleep. It also concluded that those who consistently get more than 9 hours a night can be more likely to die early too.
The survival secret of a woolly mammoth was antifreeze blood, allowing it literally to run cold. A DNA study on remains has discovered the physiological trick enabling them to thrive in sub-zero temperatures. A team isolated its hemoglobin and compared it with genetic code extracted from modern African and Asian elephants.
Do wildlife documentaries infringe animals' privacy? The author of a new report says humans assume that other species have no right to privacy during intimate moments. Brett Mills, a lecturer in film studies at the University of East Anglia, claims that footage of animals giving birth in their burrows crosses an ethical line that filmmakers should respect.
And there's a little bit of Neanderthal in nearly all of us. The first comparison of the complete genomes reveals that up to 4% of non-African human DNA is Neanderthal. It's a consequence of interbreeding between the two groups after the Great Migration from Africa. The study has been greeted as almost certain confirmation that modern humans and Neanderthals mated when the groups crossed paths.
Let's talk about some of those stories in a bit more detail. Before we get on to the really meaty ones, the sleep study, Ian, your one-word review?
Dodgy.
Anything else? Do you want to expand?
Well, when you said one word...
No, exactly. That was the summary. Anything else? No, you just don't believe it.
No.
Okay, let's move on to something else then. Woolly mammoths, as if they couldn't get any more cool with their large furry coats and their enormous sort of tusks, antifreeze in the blood. I mean, incredible.
Yeah, well, did you know, actually, woolly mammoths have got a number of adaptations that allowed them to survive in the sort of Arctic stomping grounds? And they actually have smaller ears and tails than the sort of elephantids, I suppose you'd say, that they came from, equatorial ancestors. But this is a really nice study where some guys have taken some DNA and resurrected, if you'd like, the genetic code that would give you the hemoglobin for the woolly mammoth. And what is really interesting about it is that it differs from that in African and Asian elephants because it allows it to transport oxygen around the body a lot more efficiently, which means that the woolly mammoth uses less energy in moving oxygen around its body and its bloodstream. And if it didn't have that adaptation, the researcher explained it to me as it's like you trying to carry on living with all your windows and doors open through the winter. Whereas the guy next door has insulation and everything, you are at a disadvantage because you lose energy and you have to make up for it by finding food and foraging more at a time when there isn't much food around.
Were there other species around at the same time or even around now that do a similar thing? Arctic species, perhaps?
Yeah, there are. They do it in a different way. So what's interesting is musk oxen and reindeer also have this kind of adaptation in their hemoglobin, which it's a very low energy way of transporting oxygen around the body. But the way the mammoths did it is achieves the same thing, but they evolved it separately. So it's a covert. God, I'm too tired to explain that. But they do it differently.
Okay. Were you going to say that sentence again?
I'm almost hallucinating. I'm so tired. I can actually barely see you.
Isn't nature brilliant? Talking of nature, the story about this chap who thinks that we shouldn't be filming frogs and other animals in intimate moments.
I thought there was just a perfect comment beneath this story, which is obviously quite light and fluffy, was just, do you actually mind if a frog watches you in an intimate moment? and given that probably not,
well,
why are we
fussed? Does it have a video camera and a sound crew? That's the thing.
But there's a distinction here between disturbing and right to privacy, isn't there? I mean, obviously you don't want to necessarily disturb animals and going about their daily business, but granting them then a right to privacy in that sense seems a little...
Yeah. Do animals have a right to privacy?
Well, I think there's a spectrum here. And to come back to Nell's point, I wouldn't mind if there was a frog watching me, say, having a poo. But if I was once having a poo and a cat was watching me and I felt quite odd about it, and so there's a spectrum, isn't there, between presumably me
seeing
the animal on a varying level of sentience. And a cat staring at you while you're having a poo, it's odd. Whereas if a frog's there, it can stare at whatever it likes. You don't mind, but why?
There's a difference between something looking at you and staring at you. The frog probably doesn't really recognise your existence. It just thinks you're a thing there. The cat's probably calculating in its head.
Yeah. I don't expect any of this to go out. But I think what was interesting, I mean, I feel slightly guilty because I wrote this story up with real fun. I love this story. But what Brett Mills at UEA is trying to do, the University of East Anglia, is just to start a conversation, which sounds a bit sort of silly, but there is an interesting question, I think, in if there are boundaries for observing humans, are there boundaries for observing animals? And if so, where are they? There must be a line, so where is it? And we laugh at this story and we react to it in a very sort of knee-jerk way, but it's still interesting. It's probably philosophical rather than scientific, but it is interesting.
Is it not a purely cultural thing, though? The right to privacy for human beings is about what you do in your private sort of circle might be, you might think other people might not approve of, for example, or you just don't want other people to know. Nothing to do with your daily functions. It's more of a cultural thing. So as long as frogs and cats don't have culture, then what does privacy even mean to them?
Oh, but then you get back into Jonathan Balcombe's points about whether animals do have culture in that way, or certainly a level of sentience that we ought to be respecting and not sort of dismissing out of hand.
Show me a dolphin that uses a telephone and I'll give it some respect.
I think Nell's point is the sort of point I want to make, is that in this argument, somewhere there is this bigger question of, you know, human hubris in terms of saying that we understand nature to the fullest extent and we can impose our values on, you know, other animals. And I don't think, you know, there is a gradation in the animal world, and I think we don't know how that pans out. So
this story specifically talks about nature documentaries perhaps infringing on privacy. I mean, do you think that's an infringement?
Well, one of the points he picked up on was that there was some filming in the Arctic where they were looking at trying to capture some footage of a narwhal under the Arctic ice, and this it kind of swam under the ice, and you know, that it behaved in a way that suggested it kind of wanted to be left alone. But the documentary filmmaker's reaction obviously was, let's get some better tech so we can go and film it. And you know, I think what the academic is talking about here, Brett Mills is talking about, is that our constant decision is to go after them, to film them no matter what. And should we just have a think about whether, you know, it's just pissing them off?
Okay, let's leave that there. Final story we'll quickly talk about is the Neanderthals. And the Neanderthal genome, it seems to be now complete. It's been going for some time. There have been sort of stories dripping out about this over the last year, about the differences between Homo sapiens and Neanderthals. What's the latest? This one's quite interesting, that we all, unless we live in Africa now, or we all have some Neanderthal in us.
Yeah, I mean, to get it, sort of pin it down, it's those people who are descended from the sort of wave out of Africa will have between 1% and 4% of their DNA will be you can trace back to a Neanderthal origin. So, and that's because basically the interbreeding that happened probably 60,000 years ago in the Fertile Crescent of the Middle East. And so obviously there were a lot of modern humans who remained in Africa and stayed there, but a lot of these other waves came out and ended up sort of populating the world and so on. I don't think anyone has ever published a proper full genome sequence, but let's call this one a whole genome sequence of the Neanderthal. It's not whole, but it's as good as we've got. Yeah. And what was interesting is they used that and then compared it with genomes from people from five different regions. And you do see this signature of Neanderthals essentially living on genetically in non-African modern humans, but not in the Africans themselves.
How do we create how do we discover the Neanderthal genome? So it's not like kind of walking up to somebody,
taking a blood sample. I think they just grabbed some hairs off the back of Alok's chair. No, they. So what they did, they got remains from 40,000-year-old remains from three or four different sites. Some really good ones from Croatia, a cave in Croatia, and they powdered down bone fragments weighing about half a gram, and then you know, this DNA within those bone fragments is incredibly fragmented. It's contaminated with bacteria, so you have to do an awful lot of sifting through it and categorizing what is contamination, what is Neanderthal nuclear DNA, and then piecing the thing together. And that's why this is such a long haul to do this, to even come up with what is actually an incomplete genome. But it's a tour de force in terms of genetic sort of compilation.
Okay, well, we're going to leave all those stories there. If you want more on any of this stuff, you can go to guardian.co.uk/science or environmentguardian.co.uk.
Science Weekly.
Well, that's it for this week. My thanks, as ever, to The Guardian's Nell Bowes and Ian Sample, and also to Martin Robbins. Thanks also to Anil Anantswamy. His book, The Edge of Physics, is out now. Next week, we're going to examine bodies with Susie Orbach. Among other things, she'll hopefully explain to us why women in China are having their legs broken and then extended by several inches. We'll be listening in to brain cells as they recall memories. Plus, more details on our mysterious event on the 26th of May. Just remember to put it in your diary. Don't forget to have your say with what we're doing at guardian.co.uk/scienceweekly. And make sure you subscribe to this podcast while you're there. This podcast was produced by Andy Duckworth. I'm Alok Jha. Thanks for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.